Cyrus agrees, but looks at me suspiciously. This is called the flop, I explain, putting three cards face up on the table. You want to bet?
Yes. I'll bet one question.
I'll match you. I deal another card, and we go through the process again. Eventually, there are four questions on the table. I have two pairs, aces and sevens, to his two kings. I rub my hands together. Right, let's get started. Do you have any family?
A brother,
he replies. What about your parents?
They're dead.
How did they die?
They were murdered.
I look for the telltale signs that he's lying, but see nothing except sadness and regret. How old were you?
13.
Who killed them?
You've had your four questions.
Annoyed, I deal another hand. Win again. Who killed them?
My brother.
I take a moment to digest the news. I wonder if I'm missing the lie, but can see only the truth. I want to know the details. At the same time, I wish I could take my questions back and give Cyrus some privacy. I don't want to play this game anymore, I say, pushing my chair away from the table.
But I didn't get to ask a question.
You were never going to beat me.
Are you that good?
Yes. Inwardly, I curse my bravado. What have I got to boast about? You can ask me one thing, I say softly. But not my name, or where I came from, or anything about Terry.
What will you do if you get out of here?
It's always the same question, I think. What do you want to be when you grow up, little girl? It's as if jobs come on racks like clothes, hanging up before you. Butcher, baker, tinker, tailor, waitress, receptionist. Pick one. Try it on for size. I want to start my life, I say. I've spent 6 years in places like this. It's my turn.
Your turn for what?
To be normal.
Chapter 13. Looking at Evie now, it is difficult to picture the filthy urchin they discovered in a secret room 6 years ago. The child who came out at night and hid during the day, who stole food from neighbouring houses, drank from garden hoses, and kept two Alsatians alive, who quite possibly heard a man being tortured to death and later watched his body putrefying. Clearly intelligent, despite her lack of formal education, every escape and failed fostering attempt set Evie back academically, but she hasn't fallen too far behind her peers. Dyslexia makes reading difficult, but she has good language and numeracy skills. I spent last night going over her earliest interviews with counsellors and social workers. They were searching for clues about her background, but Evie revealed almost nothing. She asked for food when she was hungry and water when she was thirsty. She didn't start conversations or answer questions with more than a yes or no. Linguists and dialect experts were brought in to study her speech patterns and accent. One said that Evie had spent time in Scotland. Another detected possible East European traces in her voice, in particular how she made rainbow sound like Rambo and mixed up her tenses. I don't recognise any trace of an accent. Instead, I see a teenager with heightened defences, who trusts nobody. Right now, she's slouching in a chair, rolling her tongue, acting bored. Why do you wear so much makeup? I ask.
I hate my freckles. They make my face look dirty.
Your freckles are the best part. Evie looks at me with a mixture of pity and disgust. She doesn't like being complimented. Praise is for other people. You didn't answer my question. What will you do?
I'll get a job.
Doing what? Don't say you'll play poker.
There are professional poker players.
They have funds, a stake. Where will you live?
I'll rent somewhere.
Do you know how much it costs to rent a flat? What about electricity, gas, phone bills, the TV license fee?
I'll get a room in a shared house.
You don't like people, Evie. You don't trust them. She gives me a pitying stare.
Guthrie said you wanted to help me. Another fucking lie. You're like all the others.
No, Evie. But even if you had savings and a job and a place to stay, a judge might still not let you go. He's going to ask for a mental health assessment, which means getting evidence from social workers, doctors, therapists.
Fuck them,
spits Evie.
I'm not a freak.
Nobody thinks that.
Yes, they do.
Before I can respond, a clanging bell rattles the air, reverberating from speakers in different parts of the building.
Lockdown, says Evie.
She's on her feet.
I have to go back to my...
Her words are cut short by a scream from the corridor. A woman stumbles through the door, holding her stomach. The front of her dress is changing colour, growing darker towards her thighs and knees.
He stabbed me,
she says, disbelievingly.
Where did he get a knife?
I pull her further into the room. People are running. Two male orderlies flash past the open doorway and then retreat just as quickly. Knife! Yells one of them. Stay back! A moment later, a teenage boy appears, wild-eyed and wired, edging backwards into the room. He looks over his shoulder and spins around, pointing a knife at me. I raise my hands and retreat. He pushes the table across the doorway, barricading the entrance. Our escape. I make the wounded woman sit down, telling her to stay calm. What's your name?
Roberta.
You must keep still and keep pressure on the wound. I show her how to make a fist and push it hard into her stomach.
How are things, Brody?
Asks Evie, making it sound like they're discussing the weather. The boy blinks at her, his thin face bubbling with acne and switching between rage and misery.
The bitch! The fucking bitch!
What did she do?
Asks Evie.
Took my magazines?
Your porn?
It weren't all porn,
stammers Brody, wiping the back of his mouth.
This is fucked, this whole place.
His face folds like an accordion, grimacing and twitching. She needs a doctor, I say, still crouched next to Roberta.
I hope she dies,
says Brody, carving at the air with the knife. The alarm is still clanging, almost drowning out his words. Evie has moved closer. I tell her to stop.
You want some of this?
Says Brody, swishing the blade at her face.
You're not going to stab me,
she responds, opening her arms as if saying, here I am.
Maybe I'll fuck you first.
Why?
Because you're an uppity bitch who thinks your shit don't stink.
You barely know me.
Davina and two male orderlies are standing in the doorway, watching in horrified silence. Evie has stepped closer. Her voice is calm, and nothing about her seems tense or uncertain.
Please, stay back,
I tell her. She ignores me and moves into range.
Do you really hate me, Brody? I don't hate you. We're all victims in here. Prisoners. Pawns. You say I never talked to you. I'm talking now. What do you want to say?
It doesn't work like that.
What doesn't?
Brody tries to speak, but the statement gets lost in his stuttering. He swallows and curses himself.
How does it work?
Asks Evie, who is standing next to him now. She takes Brody's wrist and pulls the knife towards her chest, pointing it at her heart.
This is the best place. One push, and I'll be dead.
Brody tries to pull the blade away. Evie holds it steady. She leans her head forward until her forehead touches his, and they're staring into each other's eyes.
If you do it quickly, I won't feel a thing,
she whispers.
You'll be doing me a favour.
I don't hate you that much.
You called me an uppity bitch.
You don't talk to people.
I've got nothing to say.
Davina is pleading with Evie to step back, but nobody dares to move because the knife is so close to her heart. Brody looks confused, lost. He tries to pull away again. Evie groans, and I can't tell if the knife has entered her chest.
Don't, Brody stammers, but doesn't get to finish the statement before Evie rams her forehead into his face.
The crack of bone and spray of blood tell me she's broken his nose.
Brody teeters back, uttering a curse, holding his face. The knife clatters to the floor.
Two male orderlies vault over the table and wrestle Brody to the ground. Evie touches her forehead, as though concerned she might have a bruise. Then she bends and picks up the knife.
"Give it to me," says Davina.
Evie caresses the blade almost lovingly before spinning it across her palm so the handle is facing Davina.
Moments later, the paramedics arrive, calling out numbers and driving needles into Roberta's veins, giving her fluids before strapping her to a stretcher and wheeling her through the reception area to a waiting ambulance.
I escort Evie back to her room, where she checks herself in the mirror, making sure that her makeup hasn't smudged.
"Do you have a death wish?"
I ask, after a silence.
"He was never going to stab me."
"How do you know?"
She sighs and shrugs wearily.
"I could tell."
Chapter 14. Lenny Parvel's secretary, Antonia, is a plump, playful woman with cat-eye spectacles and wrists that jangle with multiple metal bracelets. Her desk is wedged between three filing cabinets that look like grey standing stones.
"Milk, no sugar,"
she says, bringing me a cup of tea.
"Digestive or hobnob?"
"Not for me."
"Don't tell me you're on a diet. There's nothing off you. Women like a little meat on the bone."
She winks at me wickedly and takes a biscuit. I notice flat-packed boxes leaning against a wall.
"Are you moving?" I ask.
"Haven't you heard? DCI Parvel is being transferred."
"To where?"
"Uniformed operations."
"She's an investigator."
"I don't think she was given a choice."
My surprise borders on shock. "Why?" Antonia gives me an exaggerated shrug.
"Nobody tells me anything."
Then she leans closer and whispers the name Heller Smith. Timothy Heller Smith is the rising star of the Nottinghamshire Police, a future chief constable if the pundits are to be believed, as well as the conga line of hangers-on. Heller Smith has overseen intelligence and operations for the past 5 years, claiming credit for a string of major drug busts and the arrest of a gang of British-born Islamists who had returned after fighting with ISIS in Syria. There's no way Lenny would have asked for a transfer. Ever since I've known her, she's worked towards becoming a detective.
"If you ask me, Heller Smith wants her out of the way,"
whispers Antonia, brushing biscuit crumbs from the shelf of her bust.
"Lenny isn't a threat."
"A lot of people are suggesting that the next chief constable should be a woman."
She taps her nose, as if she's giving me the name of a sure thing running in the 3:30 at Doncaster. The office door swings open, and Lenny emerges, shrugging on her overcoat.
"There's a car downstairs."
"Where are we going?"
"Jodie Sheehan had a school locker."
Lenny picks up keys at the front desk, and we take a side door into the parking area. She presses the fob and waits for the telltale blink of lights to show her to the car.
"Why didn't you tell me?" I ask.
"About what?"
"Uniformed operations."
"We're not married, Cyrus."
"You love this job," I say.
"We're not talking about it."
"Isn't there something you can do?"
"Yeah, I can tell people to mind their own business."
Lenny eases out of the car park, and we head southwest along Rectory Road until we reach the West Bridgeford Baptist Church and turn right towards the River Trent. It's 10 minutes before she speaks again.
"I'm thinking of retiring. I can take it next year and get a full pension."
"And do what?"
"What do other people do? They travel, read books, binge-watch TV."
"They die young."
"Not all of them."
There is another long pause before her shoulders rise and fall in a sigh.
There are some right bastards loose on this earth, Cyrus, and some of them are supposed to be on the side of the angels.
Forsyth Academy takes up a corner of the Clifton playing fields less than 500 yards from where Jodie's body was found. Knocked down, rebuilt and renamed 8 years ago, it looks more like a germ warfare laboratory than a secondary school. Lenny pulls up in front of a green electric barrier and presses the intercom, announcing herself to the office. The gate slides open and we drive past all-weather pitches where boys in black trousers and untucked white shirts are playing football. Meanwhile, the girls are sitting on benches in the weak sunshine or clustered around tables in the quadrangle. A young student comes to escort us, her blonde ponytail swinging as she walks. A piece of colourful braided rope is tied around her wrist.
"Some of the girls are making them," she explains. "They're a memory of Jodie. Would you like one? They're free."
She reaches into her pocket and produces four similar-looking bracelets of different colours. I choose one, as Mr. Graham appears, the executive head teacher.
"Thank you, Cassie," he says, nodding to the girl. "That bracelet isn't part of the official uniform."
He notices me tying one around my wrist and lets the subject drop. Mr. Graham is in his late 50s, with a long, thin face that falls like a landslip towards his chins. He whispers his greetings.
"Dreadful business. Such a shock. We're all feeling it. The staff, the students."
The office door closes.
"Some girls have been crying for days. I've called a school assembly for midday. What do I say to them?"
He seems to be addressing me. Instinctively, I understand why. He knows who I am, about my family, and this somehow gives me some special insight or monopoly on words that might help children cope with loss. I'm transported back to my first day at school following the funerals of my parents and sisters. My grandparents wanted to keep my life as normal as possible, so I went back to the same school. Miss Payne escorted me to my first class, biology. As I walked into the room, I was greeted with absolute silence. A pin dropping would have sounded like a crashing cymbal. My eyes didn't leave the floor. I don't blame my classmates for staring at me. I blame Elias. It was always my brother's fault.
"Should I tell them Jodie was murdered?"
asks Mr. Graham. "I think that ship has sailed," I reply, regretting my sarcasm. I start again. "Be honest. Don't manufacture emotions. Don't say, 'I know what you're going through,' or tell them you've lost someone too. Don't offer your thoughts and prayers. Don't look for a bright side. There isn't any."
"What do I say?"
"Listen."
"I can't listen to them all."
"You can't even listen to me." "Children are especially vulnerable to grief. Some will struggle with how to communicate their sadness or fear or confusion. Accept their feelings. Not all of them will have known Jodie, so don't say that everyone will miss her. Say that you're sad for her friends and her family." I want to warn him about inviting bereavement counsellors into the school, because they can reinforce the idea that people should be traumatised. I know this because I've been there, passed between psychiatrists, therapists and counsellors, who squawked at me like seagulls fighting over spilled chips, spending hours telling me how I should be feeling or asking me to vent when I simply wanted to be left alone. Lenny interrupts.
"We're here to look inside Jodie Sheehan's locker."
"Yes, of course,"
says Mr. Graham, picking up his phone and asking his secretary to get Mr. Hendricks.
"Ian is Jodie's form tutor," he explains. "Every child at Forsyth Academy is assigned a tutor who becomes their main adult contact at the school. Someone they see every day, who calls the roll and checks their uniforms. Students are encouraged to talk to their tutor about any problems at home or at school. Issues around bullying or homework or participation."
"Did Jodie have any problems?" I ask.
"Ian will certainly know."
"How long was Jodie a student here?"
"Since year 7. She was quite special because of her skating. Her parents approached me and asked if we could offer her extra tutoring and waive some of the normal rules regarding attendance. We accommodated Jodie's absences as best we could.
Someone knocks. The door opens. Ian Hendricks is wearing casual trousers and an open-necked shirt. He's in his mid-30s, slim and athletic, with flecks of grey in a ponytail that he has twirled into a samurai knot at the back of his head. Straight away I clock him as the cool teacher, a John Keating figure who wins over his students by reading poetry or standing on his desk or listening to the popular music. I bet he has an Instagram account and uses Snapchat.
DCI Parvel and Dr. Haven wish to look inside Jodie Sheehan's locker, explains Mr. Graham. They also have some questions about Jodie. I thought you were the best person to ask.
Hendricks looks less than keen.
I don't have a key to her locker.
Well, call maintenance and get bolt cutters.
Moments later, we're escorted along a covered walkway to a two-story brick building with stairs at either end. Children call out to Hendricks, who waves back, using their first names.
Do you know them all? I ask. 800 students. I don't think so.
He forces a laugh.
What about Jodie? I've been her form tutor since last year. She missed a lot of school with her skating. I helped her to catch up.
How did you do that?
I collected the relevant notes from her teachers and emailed her homework and assignments.
Was she popular? I ask.
I think so. Everybody knew her.
Outgoing?
Yes.
Academic?
Not really.
He gazes past me at a window, high up on the stairwell.
Some students are naturally gifted, but Jodie had to work hard to keep up. Some of her teachers complained that she fell asleep in class, but most understood the hours she trained.
Did you ever see her compete? I ask.
No, but I used to wonder if it was cruel.
In what way?
Making a child work that hard. Up every morning at 6, a special diet, gym sessions, weight work, dance classes, acrobatics. She didn't have time for a childhood.
You make it sound like child abuse.
More like white slavery.
He smiles wryly.
Some parents expect too much of their children, and others expect too little. Both can be equally damaging.
The metal lockers are lined along the walls around the base of the stairwells. A maintenance man in a grey uniform arrives with a set of bolt cutters that slice easily through the soft metal of a cheap padlock. Lenny tosses me a pair of disposable gloves and puts on a similar pair, smoothing them over her fingers. The locker door squeaks on stiff hinges. The inner surface is plastered with photographs cut from magazines. There are no skaters this time. Instead, Jodie has chosen boy bands, pop singers and film stars. I recognise Justin Bieber and Ed Sheeran. Lenny takes photographs of the undisturbed locker, which is divided by two metal shelves. School textbooks are stacked upright at the bottom, along with several ring-bound folders, which Jodie has decorated with stickers. The top shelf has brightly coloured storage containers full of pens, highlighters, flashcards, hand cream, hairbands, cough drops, chapsticks, chewing gum, a small zippered makeup bag, a bundle of greetings cards. Lenny is flicking through the ring-bound folders. I look at the cards. Some of them celebrate Jodie's birthday, while others are Valentines from secret and not-so-secret admirers. I look for names, clues. One has a flower pressed between the pages, a blue forget-me-not. The inscription reads, "I am not too young, you are not too old. I am your Ruth, and you are my Tommy. Never let me go."
"What is it?"
asks Lenny, looking over my shoulder.
"A Valentine."
"Is that Jodie's handwriting?"
I compare it to the notes in her subject folders.
"She must have written it and run out of courage."
I look at the quote again.
"It's from a novel by Kazuo Ishiguro, Never Let Me Go."
"What's it about?"
"A doomed love affair."
Ian Hendricks is sitting on the stairs, looking at his mobile. I ask him what texts Jodie was studying for her English classes.
"We were reading dystopian stories," You're her English teacher?
Yes.
Lenny continues searching. She unzips the makeup bag and quietly nudges me. I glance down and see a box of condoms. Open. She pulls back the flip top and counts. 4 of the 12 are missing.
Parents of a last to know,
she whispers. The condoms are put into a sealed evidence bag that she marks with a time, date, and location. A black rubberized torch is standing upright at the back of the locker, looking out of place. Weighing it in my hands, I unscrew the battery cap and shake out a single D-sized battery into my palm. There should be more. Holding up the torch, I peer inside and see a roll of paper. Not paper, banknotes. Hundreds, 50s, and 20s. Lenny takes the bundle from me.
It has to be 5, maybe 6,000.
Where would Jody get that sort of money? The question echoes in the stairwell, unanswered, and we both realise that Jody is not the girl that we imagined. Chapter 15. I've been standing outside the house in Hotham Road for 20 minutes, studying the way the sun throws shadows beneath the eaves and highlights the coloured glass in the LED light panels above the windows. A wind vane of Father Time on the pitched slate roof is pointed fixedly towards the west, regardless of the breeze. Number 79 is an ordinary house in an ordinary street in North London, lined with plane trees and dotted with estate agent signs and posters for the local primary school's autumn fete. This is where Evie Cormack emerged from hiding 6 years ago. Back then, the house was being renovated and the garden was overgrown. The downpipes were streaked with rust and the window frames needed painting. Wisteria had grown wild during the summer, twisting and coiling up the exterior wall, creating a floral curtain that half covered the front door. The house is in order now, but the wisteria remains, littering the steps like mauve confetti left behind by a weekend wedding. A woman emerges from the house. She has red hair and a pinched face, and she's holding a mobile phone to her ear.
Can I help you?
She shouts, not leaving the front steps.
No, thank you.
Well, piss off.
Pardon?
We don't like your sort around here.
What sort is that?
Whatever you are, a ghost hunter, psychic, true crime writer, or general sicko.
I work with the police, I say, taking out my business card.
She edges closer, squinting as she reads.
A psychologist. You're not the first.
She's still holding her mobile to her ear. She speaks to someone.
Yeah, he's one of them. I will. Bye, love.
She lowers the phone and rattles off a list of answers to questions I haven't asked.
You can't come inside. The secret room doesn't exist anymore. There are no ghosts, no hauntings, no strange sounds, no dog kennels in the garden, and we don't know what happened to Angel Face.
Defiantly, without prompting, she says,
We bought this place after the murder, okay? I know we got a bargain, but we didn't expect to be in the bloody guidebooks.
I didn't mean to trouble you, I say.
Well, don't.
She turns in her slippers and disappears inside the house, slamming the door so violently it shakes the windows.
I don't mind Francine,
says a voice from across the fence.
She's never been very friendly.
The jug-eared old man has a Scottish accent and is leaning on a rake in his garden. His baggy trousers make him look bow-legged.
I don't know what she's complaining about. She didn't live here when it happened. That was a real circus.
Circus?
The police and the reporters and the TV vans. We could barely get into the place. And the smell.
He holds out his hand and introduces himself as Murray Reed.
It was me who called the landlord because the dogs were howling at night and the lawn hadn't been mown for weeks. I figured the tenant had done a runner, skipping on the rent, you know. So I knocked on the door. When nobody answered, I pushed open the mail flap. That's when I got a whiff. That smell could have routed an army.
How well did you know Terry Boland?
I didn't know anyone by that name. called himself Bill. We said hello a few times, waved over the fence. I'd see him outside working on his car or carrying stuff back and forth.
Did you ever see him with the girl?
Never. I mean, people came and went. The killers, obviously, although nobody took much notice. I never saw that wee girl. Still makes me shudder. The thought of her alone in that house with a dead body. And then again, maybe she was better off.
What do you mean?
He couldn't hurt her anymore.
The temperature seems to drop, as though a cloud has suddenly passed across the sun. Why do you think they tortured him? I ask. Murray shrugs.
Yeah, at first I figured he must have been a gangster or a drug dealer, you know. He pissed off the wrong people. But when they found Angel Face, that all changed. Paedophile like that, kidnapping a wee girl. He deserved everything he got.
A group of school-aged children are pushing bikes along the footpath. As they get nearer, their chatter ceases. Murray yells out to one of them.
Hey, George!
A teenage boy looks up, embarrassed to be singled out. Leaving the group, he wheels his bike towards us.
This is Dr. Haven. He works with the police, explains Murray. George lives over the road. He saw Angel Face.
Only one time,
says George, who is tall and gangly, with a foppish fringe that falls over his eyes, while the rest of his hair is cut short in a wide band. When did you see her? I ask.
My dad says I'm not supposed to talk about it.
Why not?
Property prices.
Murray finds this funny. George doesn't like being laughed at.
Dad says we get too many rubberneckers driving up and down the street looking for the house. He says the police are useless. No offence.
None taken. Did you ever talk to the man who was murdered?
No.
But you saw him?
Sure.
You must have been young when it happened.
10.
And you saw the girl?
George shrugs.
I didn't know she was a girl. I thought she was a boy because she had short hair.
Where did you see her?
In the window, upstairs.
He points towards the house.
I waved to her, but she didn't wave back.
Did you tell anyone?
Only the policewoman.
Sasha Hopewell. He nods.
She came to talk to us about the robberies,
says Murray. What robberies?
A lot of us had stuff going missing. Little things, you know. I lost a cashmere blanket and a bag of licorice all sorts. Mrs. Vermeer had dog food stolen.
Someone took my Harry Potter books,
adds George,
and my snow dome of the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, we thought it was local kids until Constable Hopewell found Angel Face,
says Murray.
It's amazing how that wee lass survived all those weeks. I often wonder what happened to her, if she made it back to her family. I hope she's okay.
A different house in a different street. A shadow passes behind the frosted glass.
Who is it?
Asks a woman from behind the door.
Dr. Cyrus Haven. I'm looking for Sasha Hopewell.
She's not here.
I work with the police. Can you tell me where she is?
No.
I'm going to slide my business card under the door.
I push the card halfway, and it disappears onto the far side. After two beats of silence, the deadlock releases. A woman with burnt orange hair and thick spectacles peers at me over the security chain.
Why do you want Sasha?
I'm looking for information about a cold case.
Angel Face.
Yes.
Go away.
She shuts the door. I put my finger on the bell, letting it ring constantly. This time a man answers, her husband, telling me to leave or he'll call the police.
I am the police, I say.
They all say that.
Who do?
Leave us alone.
It's Rodney, isn't it? I talked to you on the phone. Give me 5 minutes, please. It's important. The door closes, and I can hear them arguing, whispering urgently.
Sasha told us not to.
He doesn't look dangerous.
What if it's a trick?
that he's a psychologist.
The card could be fake.
After a few more moments, the chain is unlatched, and the door opens. They're standing side by side in the hallway like parents, ready to scold a child for coming home late.
"We're not going to tell you where she is," says Mr. Hopewell.
"I understand. Can I come in?"
They look at each other as though trapped by their natural politeness. Mrs. Hopewell is a heavy-set woman in a floral dress and cardigan. Her husband is tall and lean and hunched over, as if bent by some invisible weight. He whispers to me as I pass him,
"Please, don't upset Dominique. She's not well."
Their kitchen is cold. Used tea bags have solidified in the sink, and a dripping tap rings the same note over and over. Mrs. Hopewell offers to turn on the heating. She's in her mid-60s with a fine head of chemically coloured hair, swept back and held in place by a hairband. They sit close, shoulders touching, arms crossed.
"I've been asked to look into a police cold case. I was hoping your daughter, Sasha, might be able to help me."
"She can't," says Mr. Hopewell.
"She won't," echoes his wife. "Haven't you done enough to hurt her?"
"I don't understand what you're talking about."
"I wish Sasha had never found Angel Face."
"Why?"
"Because we lost a daughter,"
says Mrs. Hopewell, her chest expanding and collapsing in a sigh. I don't know what these people are talking about, but their pain is real.
"Please, can you start at the beginning?"
A look passes between them. They don't trust me, but whatever has happened has gone on too long.
"When Sasha finished school, she applied to join the police force. I didn't think it was a proper career for a woman, not like nursing or teaching. But she had her heart set on it. She tried twice to join the Metropolitan Police, but missed out. She was too young the first time. Then they said she had to live in London to be eligible."
"That's why she became a special constable," adds Mr. Hopewell. "She said it was a stepping stone, the next best thing."
They both fall silent. I wait. It begins again.
"That all changed when she found Angel Face. It made her famous for a while. Everybody wanted to talk to her. The newspapers, TV shows, magazines. She thought it might help her career, but it caused her nothing but grief."
"Why?"
"It never stopped. The late-night phone calls and the people following her."
"Are you talking about reporters?"
"At first, yes. But then other people came calling. Some wouldn't take no for an answer. We had two burglaries and her car was vandalised."
"When you say they, who did these things?"
Mrs. Hopewell erupts.
"You tell us!"
I can't answer her.
"Where is Sasha now?"
"Travelling."
"Can you be more specific?"
"Last week she was in France. A month ago it was Germany. Before that we got postcards from Scotland, Italy and Ireland."
Mr. Hopewell motions to the fridge, which is entirely covered in cards.
"She never stays in the same place more than a few days. That's why they can't find her."
"Who?" I ask.
"The people who are looking for her."
He makes it sound so obvious.
"Have you ever met these people?"
"No."
"Does Sasha know their names?"
"No."
"Was she ever threatened?" I ask.
"Everything was a threat," says her father.
We're going around in circles.
"They weren't reporters," says Mr. Hopewell. "They didn't leave their names. Sometimes they watched the house, or they followed Sasha to work, or when she went to the shops. They thought she could lead them to Angel Face."
"Did Sasha tell the police?"
"Nobody believed her. They thought she was being paranoid. That's why they wouldn't let her join the Met. They labelled her as too unstable."
"Can I phone her?" I ask.
"She doesn't have a phone."
The irony isn't lost on me.
"She rings us," says Mr. Hopewell. We never know when she'll call. Sometimes she contacts her brother or her aunt.
She's covering her tracks.
Can you bring Sasha back?
Asks his wife. She's holding his hand beneath the table. What do I say? I don't understand why she's gone. Mr. Hopewell turns to me and struggles to speak.
You want to know the worst thing? I'm angry with Sasha. I wish she had never grown up. I wish we could have locked her in a room and stopped her leaving home. We sit here, waiting for the phone to ring or hoping for a postcard. That's our future. That's what we look forward to when we wake up every morning. Each day begins and ends with her.
On the drive back to Nottingham, the rain arrives, sweeping in from the west in sheets that blur the landscape of fields and forests. My wipers struggle, slapping against the side of the windscreen like a soggy metronome. I go over my visit to the Hopewells. A part of me wants to dismiss their suspicions as paranoia, but neither of them had been looking for confirmation or justification. Paranoid people believe the world is conspiring against them and that mistakes are never their fault. Paranoid people focus on what they want to see. At the same time, I don't buy into conspiracies. I'm not saying they don't exist, but too many people are drawn to complicated answers rather than obvious ones. They want to believe that arch-villains or shady organisations or the deep state are manipulating society, pulling the strings. In reality, there isn't some shooter in the grassy knoll, or child sex ring in the pizza shop, or secret group controlling the world. To misquote Mark Twain, it isn't what we don't know that gets us into trouble. It's what we know for sure that just isn't so. Chapter 16. Angel Face.
The minibus is supposed to leave at noon. I stand back while the others jostle to get on board, calling shotgun on certain seats or demanding to sit next to the window.
Will you get on the sodding bus?
Says Miss MacReady, pinching Nat on the forearm.
Ow! What did I do?
You're being a twat, she says, under her breath, but loud enough for me to hear. Miss MacReady's partner, Judy, is driving the bus. She looks like a nightclub bouncer or a rugby manager with her square head, boxy clothes and tightly cropped hair.
I know who wears the pants in that relationship,
whispers Chloe. What does that mean? I ask.
She's the butch one. She goes on top.
Do lesbians worry about tops and bottoms, I wonder? Chloe considers herself an expert on sex, having boasted about giving blowjobs to her older brother's friends and her biology teacher, who got sacked when he texted her a picture of his dick. He thought it was anonymous, but he forgot to crop the image, which included a coffee cup that said, "Old teachers never die, they just lose their class." Irony 101. I take a seat near the front, where I'm less likely to be hassled. I plug in my music, but can still hear Chloe commandeering the back seat and choosing who gets to sit next to her. Miss MacReady does a head count and tells everybody of the penalties that await anyone who misbehaves. She's almost finished when Reno steps on the bus. A cheer goes up, because Reno is one of the most popular members of staff. He's young and into music, and he likes discussing last night's episode of Love Island. He also plays keyboards in a pub band called Roadkill. They once came to Langford Hall and did a gig, which was the most fun anyone could remember, unless you ask the neighbours. Reno sits next to me and holds out his fist for a bump. I do it reluctantly, glancing at him quickly before looking away again, seeing the stubble on his cheeks and the stud in his earlobe. Some of the boys wolf whistle and chorus, "Ooh." I don't react, but I'll get them later. Reno is just back from his honeymoon in Sri Lanka. He showed me where that was on a map, but I couldn't tell if it was a long way away because I have no sense of distance. The bus pulls out of the driveway and heads through the streets until the houses give way to pound stores and pawn shops. We pass an Islamic bookshop, a kosher butcher, an Arab grocer, and an Asian supermarket. People call it the Great Melting Pot, but nothing is melting or blending. I like it that way, with everybody being different. What I don't like are the old people, who keep complaining about stuff. The noise and the traffic and the cost of living. Grey and puffy as dumplings, they hobble along footpaths and wait at bus stops and count out their change at supermarket checkouts, humming with disapproval every time a young person speaks too loudly or moves too quickly or simply breathes. Don't ride your skateboard. Don't play your music. Don't wear those clothes. The minibus stops at a red light. Reno is reading a story on his phone. It's about a schoolgirl who was raped and murdered in Nottingham. Who did it? I ask.
Some sicko.
How can you tell?
What?
How do you know when someone is sick in the head or when they're just plain bad?
Reno shrugs.
Is that why we're in Langford Hall? I ask.
Nobody thinks you're sick or bad.
I turn away, resting my forehead against the glass, watching the window grow foggy with each breath. At the cinema, we wait while Miss MacReady buys our tickets. Arcade machines beep and blink with bright lights. A group of teenage boys are playing table football, knowing the girls are checking them out. Chloe grabs Reba and pulls her over to the boys. Chloe has all the moves, pointing her front toe, pushing out her boobs and smiling coyly. Straight away, she's targeted the best-looking one, who has blonde hair cut short and gelled into spikes like he's channeling his inner hedgehog. I notice his smoky grey eyes and his clear skin, but most of all, his confidence. Where does it come from? Does it come with age, or testicles, or can it be ordered online from Amazon? Next-day delivery. The boy has his arm around Chloe, running it down her back, letting it drift lower.
Chloe Pringle!
Barks Miss MacReady, giving the boy the evil eye. She marches Chloe back to the group. Chloe looks over her shoulder and mouths the word, later, tossing her hair again for the sake of tossing it. We queue for popcorn. I let the others push past me. Reba takes an age to choose what she wants because she's careful with her money. The guy behind the counter acts like he's got a plane to catch. He hands Reba her change. She looks at her hand, saying,
"This isn't enough."
"What?"
"I gave you 20 quid."
"You gave me a tenner."
"No."
He opens the till and holds up a £10 note.
"See?"
"I gave you a 20,
says Reba, growing anxious and looking around for support.
"Next,"
says the man, looking past her.
"I brought 20 quid, I know I did."
Reba looks at Miss MacReady, then at Chloe and Nat and the rest of the group.
"I gave him a 20, I swear."
"You must be mistaken,"
says Miss MacReady.
"It's my birthday money. Mum sent it to me."
The man behind the counter interrupts.
"She gave me a tenner, okay. I get kids coming in here all the time trying to pull this scam."
"It's not a scam,"
says Reba, her voice changing pitch. Miss MacReady tells her to calm down and step away from the counter.
"But he stole my money."
"Be quiet, Reba," she scolds and apologises to the man, saying she's sorry for causing trouble. I've been watching from the back of the queue. Reluctantly, I step forward.
"She's telling the truth."
Miss MacReady frowns.
"Did you see her hand over the money?"
"She's not lying."
Miss MacReady pulls me closer to the counter.
"You were standing way back there, Evie. How could you see what money she handed over?"
"She gave him a 20.
"They're both in on it," says the man. "It's a scam."
"You're trying to rip her off,"
I reply, shifting my slouch from one hip to the other. The man behind the counter grows flustered.
"I'll call the manager. You'd all have to leave."
"You won't call the manager," I say.
"Maybe I'll call the police."
"Go on then."
The conviction in my voice seems to surprise him. He's not used to being contradicted, not by a girl. He leans towards me, and I brace myself, expecting to be slapped. Reno intervenes, protecting me, giving me confidence.
"I think you've done this before," I say. "I bet you put that 20 straight into your pocket."
The man reacts with fake outrage.
Empty your pockets, says Reno.
The man mutters something under his breath and opens the till. He takes out an extra £10 note and tosses it towards Reba. She picks it off the floor and puts the money deep into the back pocket of her jeans. I hope you weren't lying, mutters Miss MacReady as she walks behind me into the cinema. Reba is ahead of us. She looks over her shoulder as though wanting to say thank you, but not remembering the words.
Chapter 17. Sunday afternoon, in the shadows of Nottingham Castle, two boys and a girl, roughly the same age, are pushing a wheelbarrow across the square. Slumped inside is a crude effigy of Guy Fawkes, stuffed with straw or rags, with red woolen hair, a flat cap, and mismatched buttons for eyes. They're a bit late, I say. Bonfire night was a week ago.
Maybe they're getting a head start on next year, says Caroline Fairfax.
Evie Cormack's lawyer is in her early 30s, with dark, wavy hair held back from her face by an Alice band. She's dressed in a cream-coloured blouse and blue denim jeans that look brand new. She reaches for the sugar and fills a spoon twice, stirring as though it might solidify if she didn't. You don't see Guy Fawkes' effigies very often anymore, I say.
That's not a bad thing, she replies. Anti-Catholic rituals are rather outdated.
Are you Catholic?
Heavens no. I'm an equal opportunity atheist.
She licks foam from her spoon. Across the road, Japanese tourists are posing for photographs in front of a Robin Hood statue. Cast in thick bronze, Robin has a green tinge and is about to unleash an arrow at a tourist stand selling felt hats, medieval tunics, Maid Marian wimples and Friar Tuck teddy bears. Where do you stand on Robin Hood? I ask, enjoying the banter.
He was a dangerous progressive who gave money to spongers and welfare cheats. Nowadays they'd lock him up, or make him leader of the Labour Party.
She smiles, and I feel a jolt of attraction as her eyes meet mine. In that moment it feels like she has mentally grabbed hold of my testicles and given them a tug. I look away and try not to blush. I expect her to look away as well, but Caroline's eyes are still searching my face. She licks the spoon again. Evie's case is on Wednesday, I say.
Are we allowed to be talking?
What do you mean?
Maybe you're going to be a witness for the other side.
Are there sides? I ask. We all want what's best for Evie. She looks at me doubtfully.
Why do people always see that when they're taking the choice away from someone?
Do you think Evie is ready?
My job is to ask questions of people like you, who seem to think she's too damaged to be allowed out into the big bad world.
You must have an opinion.
I'm a legal aid lawyer, not a psychologist.
How old were you when you left home? I ask. The question annoys her.
I don't see what difference that makes.
Was it university?
Yes.
You went home for the holidays. You had a student loan, a car, regular money from your parents.
What are you trying to say?
Evie doesn't have any support. No family to fall back on.
We can't keep people locked up because they don't have parents or family money.
I hesitate, about to ask another question, but Caroline gets in before me.
I know who she is.
Pardon?
Evie, I know the truth.
I play dumb.
She's Angel Face.
There is a beat of silence. Caroline lowers her voice.
A guest? How many people her age can't prove how old they are?
You can't tell anyone.
I know the law, Dr. Haven.
Please, call me Cyrus. Outside, another group of tourists are carrying matching red shoulder bags and following a guide who is twirling a yellow umbrella like a baton. Caroline speaks next.
Do you want to keep Evie locked away?
No.
Then why are you here?
I don't know how to answer her, or if it's appropriate to tell her the truth. How do I explain that Evie Cormack has lodged under my skin like a splinter but irritates me at unexpected moments? She fascinates and alarms me, and makes me realise why I became a psychologist. Normally, when someone is balanced and copes well with day-to-day life, there's no point in trying to unlock their psyche. More importantly, it can be dangerous to tinker with a machine that isn't broken. Most people learn to live with trauma and deprivation by developing coping mechanisms. They get on with life rather than dwelling on failure or loss. I don't know if Evie remembers what happened to her or has chosen to forget. The idea of traumatic memories being suppressed and coming to the surface later has divided psychologists and neurologists for 30 years, but the memory wars of the 1990s were never resolved. I don't think Evie has suppressed memories. We know some of what she endured. She listened to a man being tortured to death. She spent weeks in a house with his decomposing body. She was sexually abused from a young age, and doctors doubt if she'll ever be able to have children. Yet, despite being treated by a legion of therapists, counsellors, and psychologists, she has never spoken about what she witnessed, or how she came to be in the secret room. I don't care how untouched or untroubled she may appear to be, she will have scars. She does remember. Caroline runs her finger around the rim of her coffee cup, collecting the remaining froth. "Would you like another?" I ask.
"I don't have time," she replies, glancing at her phone. "About Evie, can I call you as a witness?"
"No."
"But you've talked to her?"
"She's told me nothing."
"You've read her files?"
"Same answer."
"Was it really so bad? What happened to her?"
I lean closer. "So far, I haven't found anyone who doesn't consider Evie to be a danger to herself and to others."
"And you agree?"
"Not completely. I think Evie is self-destructive, self-hating, antisocial, and impervious to criticism. Yet she's also the most self-aware, undaunted, sanguine person I've ever met. She doesn't appear to need friends, or approval, or human interaction. That doesn't make her dangerous to anyone other than herself, although she has a history of attacking people whom she perceives as having wronged her in some way."
"You think she should be locked up indefinitely?"
says Caroline. "I didn't say that. I want to help Evie, but I haven't worked out exactly how to do it."
"That's still not a reason to keep her at Langford Hall."
"No." Caroline's face seems to transform, growing softer.
"Nobody else in my office wanted this case. They gave it to me because I'm the newbie. I've litigated 2 cases in my short career, and now I'm appearing before the High Court."
"You'll be fine," I say, hoping I sound convincing.
"But you're right. They're going to ask Evie how she can support herself, where she'll live. I don't have anything to tell them."
"I wish I could help you." Caroline collects her briefcase from beside the table. "Are you going to put her on the stand?" I ask.
"I don't think I have a choice."
"Don't do it. She's not... She'll..." I can't finish.
"What else can I do?"
"Anything but that." Chapter 18. Chief Superintendent Timothy Heller Smith strides into the incident room, yelling, "We got him!" and pausing to punch at the ground like he's pull-starting a lawnmower. Cheers echo across the open plan office, accompanied by fist bumps and high fives. 3 words have changed the entire mood of the task force, sweeping away the exhaustion and fatigue. Lenny Parville is with him, along with a uniformed constable, nervous at being thrust into the spotlight. Lenny doesn't seem to share Heller Smith's enthusiasm, but says nothing as she lets her superior take charge of the briefing. Detectives gather to hear the details. I join them, standing at the back, leaning against the wall. Heller Smith looks more like a politician than a senior police officer, dressed in an expensively cut suit and red silk tie. His thin, sparse hair is dyed black and heavily oiled, and his mouth is permanently open, like a thick-lipped fish.
"This is Constable Harry Plover,"
he announces, getting the name wrong and having to be corrected.
"PC Glover has provided us with a breakthrough in the Jodie Sheehan case. But let's hear the story from him."
I can see Lenny seething, but she's not going to create a scene. The young PC looks nervously around the room, holding his hat in his hands.
"It was last Wednesday afternoon. The day after we found Jodie, I was at Silverdale Walk, protecting the crime scene, when this guy came along, walking his dog. He got all chatty with me, saying he used the footpath most days and knew the area well. I asked him if he'd noticed anyone odd hanging around the footpath, maybe someone who was following women and such. He said I should show him a photograph if we find a suspect. I took down his name and address.
Lenny motions for him to go on.
Later that afternoon, I had a couple of girls come up to me. They were putting flowers on Jodie's memorial, the makeshift one, near the community centre. One of them said she went to school with Jodie. I asked her when she heard the news, and she said she'd been waiting at a bus stop on South Church Drive on Tuesday afternoon when a guy came up to her. He had a dog, a Kelpie. He told them not to use Silverdale Walk because the police had found a girl's body beneath the footbridge. I asked Jodie's friend what time this was, and she said about 3:30. People knew Jodie was missing by then, but this guy had knowledge that a girl's body had been found. He pinpointed the location.
Exactly, says Hellasmith. That information wasn't released until the 6 o'clock media conference, and we made no mention of the footbridge.
He holds aloft Glover's police issue notebook.
Not only did the constable recognise the discrepancy, but he asked the girl for a description and realised that she was talking about the same person he'd spoken to earlier in the day. Outstanding work, simply outstanding.
He claps PC Glover on the shoulder, mispronouncing his name again. Lenny smiles wryly and thanks Hellasmith for his insightful summary. The words seem innocuous enough, but land like a punch. Looks are exchanged, mutual antipathy. The chief superintendent leaves, and Lenny relaxes, propping herself on a desk.
Our prime suspect is Craig Farley, 26. He lives alone in Bacon Grove, which is less than a mile from where Jodie was found. He was taken into custody an hour ago, and Socco are examining his bungalow. We know that Farley works as a porter at the Queen's Medical Centre, which is where Jodie was hospitalised with pneumonia 8 months ago. He may have seen her there and developed an infatuation. More importantly, he has form. 2 arrests for exposing himself to women in Central Park near Nethergate Stream. Both times he claimed to be nude sunbathing. The second time he was given a suspended sentence and a good behaviour bond. At aged 18, he was picked up for having sex with a minor. The girl was 14. Her parents chose not to press charges, which means Farley escaped with a caution and wasn't put on the sex offenders register.
Lenny looks from face to face, making sure that everyone is on the same page.
One of Farley's neighbours saw him on Tuesday morning carrying a bundle of clothes in a bin bag. He said he was giving them to charity, which is why we're going to check every second-hand shop and clothing bin in Nottingham.
There are groans from the detectives. Lenny ignores them, glancing instead of a clock.
We can hold Farley for another 23 hours, unless we apply for an extension. The clock is ticking. I want to know everything about him. Talk to workmates, friends, family, ex-girlfriends, neighbours. Trace his movements. This is our guy. I can feel it in my water.
What about DNA?
Asks Monroe.
The results will take 3 or 4 days. I want a confession before then. I'm going first team with Edgar. Monroe and Primetime, your second team.
Has he lawyered up?
Asks Nobody.
Not yet. We do everything by the book. We give him a break every 2 hours, plenty of liquids and regular meals. Go in hard, but don't bully him. Next briefing is at 4 o'clock.
As she turns away, she is handed a phone. The chief constable is on the line. I can hear Lenny responding.
Yes, sir. About an hour ago. Reasonably certain. We're about to start now. Yes, sir. I will, sir. You'll be the first to know.
Lenny hangs up and motions for me to follow. We head downstairs to the interview suites, located at the rear of the building. The white-painted room is furnished with a table, 3 chairs, and a one-way mirror that allows the interrogations to be observed and filmed. Craig Farley is alone, slouching in a chair, biting at a hangnail as though it's a splinter. He stands suddenly and walks to the door. He raises his fist as though ready to knock, but changes his mind. Now he's in front of the mirror, glancing past his reflection with a studied casualness, as if he's aware there might be someone watching him.
There is nothing unusual about his looks. He's 5'10", brown-haired and 30 pounds overweight. Although anxious, his face is strangely blank, as though he's not completely sure how he managed to get here. Lenny and D.S. Edgar enter the room and introduce themselves. They ask Farley if he'd like something to eat or drink. He says he wants to go home.
"You're under arrest," Lenny explains.
"There's been a mistake. You got the wrong person."
"For what?"
Farley hesitates.
"For whatever you think I did."
"I'm glad to hear it," says Lenny. "Because things were looking pretty serious for you, Craig. But if it's all a misunderstanding, we should be able to sort this out toot sweet."
She pulls her chair closer. I watch how Farley examines her, checking out her breasts and her hips. He can't help himself.
"Exactly what mistake have we made?" asks Lenny.
"I had nothing to do with that girl."
"What girl?"
"The one in the papers."
"Do you know her name?"
"Jodie something."
"You mean this one?"
says D.S. Edgar, opening a file and taking out a photograph.
"For the record, this is a recent picture of Jodie Sheehan. It was taken by a school photographer in March 2018.
Farley looks at the image and away again.
"Pretty, isn't she?"
asks Lenny.
"Not my type."
"What's your type, Craig? We know you like them young."
He doesn't answer.
"You had sex with a minor."
"I was never charged,"
Lenny corrects him.
"You were never convicted. According to the medical report, you really tore her up."
Farley nods.
"She wanted it."
"And she was your girlfriend?"
"Yeah."
"So why be so rough on her?"
"Her dad was the problem, not me."
He looks from face to face, wanting to be understood. Lenny switches focus.
"So where did you meet Jodie?"
There is a momentary glimmer of recognition in Farley's eyes, but he's taken too long to answer.
"I never met her."
"What about at the hospital?"
He frowns. Lenny produces a small plastic test tube from her pocket.
"Do you know what this is, Craig? It collects skin cells from inside your cheek. Open wide and I'll have a quick brush around."
Farley shakes his head.
"I don't trust you. You're going to plant my DNA at the scene."
"What scene?"
asks Edgar.
"On that girl. You'll take my spit and you'll spill it around."
"We're trying to remove you from our list of suspects."
Farley presses his lips together and shakes his head.
"It won't matter, Craig," says Lenny. "We can hold you down if necessary. I can get 4 officers in here right now and we'll do this the hard way."
Farley shrinks from her and glances at his reflection in the mirror, raising his hand as though he's unsure if he's watching someone else being interrogated.
"What's your dog's name?"
asks Edgar. Farley reacts as though every question is loaded.
"Clancy."
"What breed?"
"A Kelpie."
"Do you walk him every day?"
"She's a bitch."
"Where do you normally take her?"
"Lots of different places. Along the river mainly. Sometimes I go to Rushcliffe Country Park."
"How about Central Park?"
asks Lenny.
"No."
"That's right. You prefer to nude sunbathe," says Edgar.
Farley bristles.
"That was a misunderstanding."
"What about Silverdale Walk?"
asks Lenny.
"You told Constable Glover you used that footpath every day."
"Not every day."
"What about on Monday night?"
There is another pause. Silence. I can see Farley's mind working overtime because he doesn't have the intellect or the speed of thought to maintain his lies or second-guess what the detectives know or don't know. He has a below-average IQ and limited social skills, which fits with the clumsy attempt to hide Jodie's body and his lack of forensic awareness and his history of underage sex and lower-grade sexual offences. Lenny and Edgar slowly ratchet up the pressure
unpacking Farley's movements on Monday evening. There is nothing subtle about their approach. Everybody in the room knows what role they have to play, even Farley. If he were a patient of mine, I would interview him differently. I'd begin by exploring his childhood, his schooling, and his family relationships. After taking his history, I would slowly explore his sexuality and fantasies. What does he look for in a woman? What turns him on? What does he picture when he masturbates? Is it their smell, or the clothes they wear, or the way they walk? Over numerous sessions, I would identify the progression that led his normal, consensual romantic fantasies to become corrupted by thoughts of violence, exploitation, and coercion. Perhaps he was abused as a child, or maybe his first attempts at having ordinary relationships were rebuffed. Girls ignored him, or laughed at him, or belittled his failings. That's when his fantasies were formed. Richly detailed scenarios in which he won the girl and landed the job and got a nice car and cool friends